Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E. This is one of my most favorite months of the year, next to February, which is the Heart Month. This is National Adoption Month, and this is the time when I have the opportunity to share with those who are in the field and those who are not about issues related to adoption. It's National Adoption Awareness Month. And as those of you who follow our program know that every month, every week, every day is adoption awareness for some of us. And it is close to my heart that our general population, that the village knows the plight of the children that who have been faced with both separation from their biological parents, adjusting to sometimes foster parents in between, and eventually the hope and the prayer that they will have a permanent family that will adopt them. And as I often state, and it's indicated in my book, that even when a child is adopted into a permanent home, it really is not the end and they live happily ever after. There are often many other trials, and tribulations to cross over and to get through during the course of that child's life and within the families who have brought them into their hearts and into their homes. Tonight, we are going to listen to our featured guest for the launching of National Adoption Month last year in 2010, and I feel like it's always a timely message. And most of you know that I have worked closely with Mr. Les Brown, international renowned motivational speaker, and I call him my favorite adoptee. Some of you may be familiar with his story of having been raised by Ms. Mamie Brown, a single woman who adopted Les and his two brothers and cared for five other children. That is just amazing to me. And she is my shero. And actually, his story is what got me through a lot of trials as I, too, parented two boys as a single parent. So at this time, I am going to tune in and allow you to tune in with me to our program that was aired November 10th, 2010. Wow, time goes by quickly, doesn't it? And initially, the show was entitled Encouraging Greatness in Adoption, because Mr. Brown's motto generally is Step Into Your Greatness. So today, our program is entitled, I'm not sure. I missed it. Today has been a quite challenging day for me, both physically and otherwise. However, but I am here, you are here, and I am just so glad. So listen in. You'll first hear a commercial, and then it will go directly into my interview with Mr. Brown. And if you're in our chat room or listening and would like to call in, I will be here available to talk with you, to answer your questions, respond to your comments at the end of this interview. So relax and enjoy Ms. Mamie Brown's baby boy, Mr. Les Brown, following the commercial.
Thank you for being here. We know that November is National Adoption Month, and this is about where we bring attention to the general population about the plight of children both in the foster care system who are in need of adoptive homes, as well as children who have been adopted. And as a former adoption social worker and an adoptive parent myself, as I stated in my book, it's hard work being the village that raises a child. And my goal in the work that I do is to be sure that children in the system have an opportunity to be able to have a long-lived, happy, permanent relationship in their homes. And in sharing with you, I've learned a lot about your childhood experience, and as I tell everyone, you're one of my favorite adoptees.
Yes.
So one of the things that I wanted to start off with, because I know that you have lots of stories to tell and you keep us in stitches, but there's a more serious side of that as well, in terms of some of the things that you went through as a child and feeling accepted and belonging. And God bless Ms. Mamie Brown's heart, because I know she went through with you.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so what is the question that you asked?
The question is, what were some of the things that you experienced as a child that gave you a sense sometimes of not quite belonging, and then what was it that gave you that greater sense of, I do belong?
Well, I never had a feeling that I did not belong to my mother. And that was never, in fact, not only was that never an inkling or thought, but even though I know, and when Mama finally told us, I found out at around 9 or 10, a neighbor told me. And I never told my mother, nor did I tell my brothers and sisters. But by the time when I turned 18, Mama, the state had forced her to tell us, because we went from being foster kids and then we were legally adopted at 18.
Wow.
And so she had to tell us then. But even though I know that, and I know that Mrs. Mamie Brown never had any children, it is very challenging for me to wrap my mind around the fact that I did not come from her womb. And so that, because her love was so encompassing, and it's interesting how people can be born in the same situation, raised by the same parents in the same circumstances, and come away with different impressions. Even though we all love Mama, but I don't believe that Mama made the same impression, her example, on my brothers and sisters as she did on me. And that I was so encouraged and inspired by her unstoppable spirit, her magnetic personality, never meeting a stranger. And once she made up her mind that she wanted something, she would go after it.
This is senior living the way it should be. For your special offer, visit VintageSenior.com today.
Thank you for being here. We know that November is National Adoption Month, and this is about where we bring attention to the general population about the plight of children, both in the foster care system who are in need of adoptive homes, as well as children who have been adopted. And as a former adoption social worker and an adoptive parent myself, as I stated in my book, it's hard work being the village that raises a child. And my goal in the work that I do is to be sure that children in the system have an opportunity to be able to have a long-lived, happy, permanent relationship in their homes. And in sharing with you, I've learned a lot about your childhood experience. And as I tell everyone, you're one of my favorite adoptees.
Yes.
So one of the things that I wanted to start off with, because I know that you have lots of stories to tell and you keep us in stitches, but there's a more serious side of that as well in terms of some of the things that you went through as a child and feeling accepted and belonging. And God bless Miss Mamie Brown's heart, because I know she went through
long
Yes. Yes,
indeed.
Yes.
As a child that gave you a sense sometimes of not quite belonging, and then what was it that gave you that greater sense of I do belong?
Well, I never had a feeling that I did not belong to my mother. And that was never, in fact, not only did I never that I tell my brothers and sisters, but by the time when I turned 18, Mama, the state had fostered to tell us, because we went from being foster kids and then we were legally adopted at 18.
Wow.
And so she had to tell us then. And but even though I know that, and I know that, that Mrs. Mamie Brown never had any children, it is very challenging for me to wrap my mind around the fact that I did not come from her womb. And so that, because her love was so encompassing, and it's interesting how people can be born in the same situation, raised by the same parents in the same circumstances, and come away with different impressions. Even though we all love Mama, but I don't believe that Mama made the same impression, her example, on my brothers and sisters as she did on me. That I was so encouraged and inspired by her unstoppable spirit, her magnetic personality, never meeting a stranger. And once she made up her mind that she wanted something, she would go after it. She only had a third grade education. And so she did not have a methodical, well laid out plan of action to get it. She just made up her mind, I'm going to get this. and that rubbed off on me. I don't know how I do what I do, but once I make up my mind, once I see the picture complete in my mind's eye, then I go for it. That's why I talk about leap and grow your wings on the way down. And so I never had that disconnection, and I always felt very loved by her. And she was not a touchy-feely kind of person. She was not an affectionate person. She was old school, I would say, so to speak. She fixed food for us. Mama didn't sit down and eat with us. She fixed the food, and then she had this. She had rituals that she followed. She would fix the food, made sure everybody was seated to eat, and then she would go in her bedroom, and she would light up a Lucky Strike, and she would watch Animal Kingdom. So she woke up in the morning, she had her coffee and a Lucky Strike, no filter, and she had her Canadian bacon and her eggs and grits. And then she would watch Bob Barker. I remember when I had my talk show, I would call her and say, Mama, did you see my show today? No. I said, why? You know Bob Barker's my husband. I might leave my husband for you. I'm ending a nationally syndicated talk show. No talk show has ever done this. Say, this has been Mrs. Baby Brown's baby boy, and she never saw it.
Okay. She said she knew who you were, so that was enough for her.
That's right. She would not leave me for her husband.
Okay.
Well, the price
and
is right.
And she couldn't get rid of you.
That's right.
One of the things that I share with others, and especially in my book, that one of the things that really just drew me to you was your love for Mrs. Brown and the fact that she stood by you. She believed in you when nobody else did. And one of the things with our youth growing up, a lot of times caregivers become so frustrated and so like, you know, why did I even do this? Is this not worth it? It's not working. But your mom did not. What do you think gave her that strength and that ability to believe in you?
I think that her mindset was, as I think about it, because I had to think about it so that I would not lose my mind dealing with my youngest son.
Okay.
And I have a granddaughter that's crazy like me. She got that crazy Les Brown gene because I was a problem. I was a problem. My brother never got in any trouble. Wesley, he never missed a day from school, never played hooky like I did. He was an A and B student. I was a D and F student. Out of 186 students, I graduated 85 academically. And so Wesley never got in any trouble, which made things real bad for me. I used to talk to him. I said, why don't you do something? Because they think I'm crazy. And he said, you are crazy. So I think that she had this mindset that, boy, you're going to be all right, that the hard head makes a soft behind. I'm gonna whoop you behind till it roke like okra. I'm going to whoop it till the cows come home. So my mother believed that the subconscious mind was in your behind, and somehow that she was going to get to it, she was going to penetrate it, and that will get you right. I mean, today I would have been able to file child abuse charges against her. And she would not have cared. I remember once going to school and telling my teacher, Mrs. Hunter, that she, Mrs. Carr, that I had been beaten, but Mom had beat me with a switch and a belt. And so Miss Carr told my sister to tell my mother not to hit me anymore. And my mother told my sister, said, you tell Miss Carr, she run that damn school and I'll run my damn house.
Hello.
That was Mamie Brown. And then she came down to the school to meet me, you know. So Mamie Brown did not say she was a different kind of person.
Mm-hmm. And now knowing that in this day and time, that is not something that goes over very well. So it's interesting because I believe that part of your success is that you had Mrs. Brown your whole life. You didn't get bounced around from home to home like a lot of kids do, because in some cases kids have been abused. In other cases, they're just being rightfully disciplined, as in with my children, but they're given so many options to be able to be judged, you know, bumped around, and sometimes social workers just feel like, oh, well, this isn't working. But you had to be in there to work it out. What would you say to those now who have an option? You know, will say, you know, that I will, you know, just send you back, as someone actually told your mother to.
Well, they told my mother numerous times, particularly when I was brought home by the police for stealing a bicycle, or, you know, during the time I was coming up, you couldn't cross the railroad tracks. And because in Liberty City and Overtown, you were surrounded by the railroad tracks, particularly in Overtown. So if you went across the railroad tracks, now you're in white territory. So you were not allowed to do that. So I would go across the tracks and go up in the white people's mango trees and get me some mangoes. And they would always catch me or call the police and bring me home. And so they'd come and arrest me and brought me home, and Mama would always beat my butt. But here's what I realize when I look back and think about her. She had this unconditional love. She had this feeling and this spirit about her that you're going to be somebody. You're going to do something with your life. I didn't get you to fail. She never, ever gave up on me. The other ones never got in any trouble. None of my mama adopted seven of us. She first adopted Wesley and I. She was 46 at the time. Then 5 years later, and my sister hates for me to tell this story, and because it just caused her to cry when I talked about it, mama then deny this, but I know what I remember. I remember when I was 10 years old. No, I was 5. And I heard a noise at the door. There was a knock at the door. I went to look out of the door, and there was no one there. And then I heard this little sound like a baby crying. And I looked, and there was a basket on the steps. I opened the screen door, and I peeled the blanket back, and there was my sister Margaret Ann. Her father's name is Arthur Miller. So he brought her. I did not know at the time, nor did Mama know. They were laying sidewalks in Overtown. We didn't have sidewalks at that time. And he saw how well Mama was taking care of Wesley and I, and he had gotten a lady pregnant named Marion Miller, and this lady had 11 kids. And so he took the one by 11 different men. So he took his last one she had, and brought her to our house and left her in a blanket and a basket on my mother's steps. I found her, and I said, Mama, come look, there's a baby in this basket. She said, shut up, boy. I said, no, please. And so she came, and she looked, and she screamed. She said, oh, my God, whose baby is this? And people, the neighbors came out and everything. No one said anything. So Mama took Margaret Ann in. When Margaret Ann turned 14, a guy knocked on the door. He came in, and when he didn't have to say, that's my daughter, because she looked like he spit her out, Mr. Arthur Miller came and said, that's my daughter. And he said he never brought anything, never gave her anything. Oddly enough, but at least he came back. My birth parents never came back, and I never saw them. And I never had a desire when I had my talk show. The King brothers tried to get me to do a search for them, and do a show around that, but I wasn't interested in doing that. And so, but anyhow, this guy, as he got older, he called my sister and told her he wanted to see her, and he was old and couldn't take care of himself. He wanted her to take care of him, so she declined. But this thing about being adopted is fascinating. I was very fortunate not to be institutionalized and bounced around from home to home, that I was chosen with love. Wesley was chosen with love, and Angelo and Linda and Sharon and Margaret Ann and Leonard and Linda. So we were chosen by Mamie Brown with love. My mother went to jail for us when she could no longer work at the M&M cafeteria and do domestic work on Miami Beach. She started selling moonshine and wrote numbers, and she sold homebrew, and she cooked for the neighbors and washed their clothes. And a guy named Calhoun that I saw years later knocked on the door. I think I was between 10 or 12. And Mama always said, never open the door without letting her know. And I said, Mama, he said, no. I got a surprise for her. Some friends are coming here just to say hello. And I opened the door, and he pushed me up against the wall and hit me and told a guy, say, she's in the room, and the moonshine and the homebrew that she's brewing is under the linoleum floor. And they came in Mama's room. They went in Mama's room and handcuffed her and tore up the linoleum floor and went down and pulled out the cans of big gallon cans of moonshine and homebrew and the numbers box that Mama had. And I'll never forget, it just broke me up. And they brought her out in handcuffs, and she said, I told you not to open that door, Leslie. And now I was crying and trying to get her. I said, please don't take my mother, please don't. I was there by myself. And this guy, I think I was 10 years old, this is a grown man, and I was trying to get to Mama, trying to pull, say, please don't take her. And so he hit me several times, including using his blackjack. You know, he didn't have to do it, but he did it because he could. And when I used to go visit her, Wesley was very quiet. He didn't talk. Margaret Ann was quiet. She was small. They didn't take her in there. And so they would literally have to use 2 to 3 prison guards to drag me out of the place. To such an extent, they said, if you cannot leave, you cannot come in. And Mama said, please, Leslie, please, I want to see you. Promise me, when the visit time is over, you will leave and not fight them. And so I did.
Mm.
But that was a tough time in my life.
You were very, very attached to her.
Yeah.
Very attached. And you had a conversation.
I think probably because she had arthritis, and I used to, while my brothers and sisters were playing outside, I would rub her ankles, and she would tell me stories. I was thinking about this. I'm here in Chicago. I'll be doing a training tomorrow, teaching people how to become strategic and spiritual storytellers. And I believe, in fact, I know, because while I was rubbing her ankles, and she would tell me stories about her childhood, riding a horse without a saddle in Stuart, Florida, this alligator that she used to feed chickens to, that her father beat her with a buggy whip for going down to the lake to feed this alligator because he felt that this alligator would come up out of the lake and would eat her. It was a big, long alligator, and she considered this alligator her pet. And she would call this alligator, and he'd come up, have some type of way in which she communicated, and would feed him chickens. And so I would hear these stories of when she saw her birth mother. Her mother was poisoned. And her father, when he beat her with a buggy whip, she's on the couch and nursing her wounds. And I used to love this story. I tried to tape it. I'm going to find a guy. I did have a tape of it. And so this is the one she said, tell me 100 times. And I said, what happened, Mom? She said, I was on the couch nursing my wounds. And all of a sudden, the door opened. And there was this tall woman, very beautiful, with a bouquet of flowers. And she had this big, large dog. And this dog looked at me. And I tried to open my mouth to call my father to tell him that a woman and a dog was at the door. And I couldn't say anything. I couldn't open my mouth. It was like, as the dog looked at me, I was paralyzed and couldn't move and couldn't speak. And then this woman walked past me and went in the room where my father was. And she said, I could hear you making noise. All right. I promise I won't. Okay, I promise. I won't beat her anymore. I won't beat her. I promise I won't beat her anymore. And she said the woman was in there for about 15 and 20 minutes. And then she came out. She didn't say anything to Mama. She walked. The dog stood there, looked at Mama. And then when the dog turned and left, the door closed. And her father got up and asked her, said, did you see anything just now? And she said, yes. She said, that was your mother's ghost that came to me. She told me never to beat you again. She said, he said to her, you can go now. Leave. I told her I'll let you go. And she left home at 13. She packed her things. She went to town. And she didn't, he gave her any money. She went to a bar there. She was talking to people outside of a bar. So the bartender came out and said, her father's name was Stuart. Aren't you Stuart's daughter? So, yes, and she had whips all over where he beat her with a buggy whip. And so this gentleman's wife came out, and they said, oh, my God, because she had scars all over her body. And they took her in, and she worked as a waitress in this bar at 13. They didn't have age requirements at that time. And she served tables, and she sang, and she danced, and that's what she did. Until she became an adult. At 26, then she caught a Greyhound bus and came to Miami, and she had a reputation for cooking real good, so she got a job at the M&M Cafeteria in downtown Miami, which became Morrison's Cafeterias nationally. It's Morrison Cafeteria in the South. It's known in the South, but not elsewhere in the country. And she did day's work on Miami Beach, those two jobs that she did, cleaning homes on Miami Beach and cooking on Miami Beach and taking care of children. And that's so she used to tell me these stories, and I love those stories. And that's a major part of my success as a teacher, my ability to tell stories.
I'm so excited to have everybody join us tonight.
What's that noise in the background?
That's what I'm asking. That's why I ask you to hold on. If some of our callers have their call on, please mute yourself out. Thank you. there. I'm going to have to mute everyone out. Are you there? Can you hear me, Les?
Yes, I can. Yes.
Okay. What's the area code of your number so I can move you on?
I'm in Chicago. What is this? I am 847.
Okay, thank you. I will mute everyone else out. Good. Okay. It's interesting because you were sharing more about your mother's life, and I remember reading some of that story in your first book, Live Your Dreams. We had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, and she actually began to share the story of her mother's journey through her trials as a child, and I cut her off because I didn't want to get her story confused with her mother's story. So for people who have heard that story, they know, you know, what your mother's dilemma was. And I want to pull back over a little bit more because I think that the background of what you've told about your mom says a lot about her ability to endure a lot of the trials that she went through here as a child. Because I really want our listeners to get how not to give up on a child. Because, as I said, you would have been one of my kids. You made the comment about, you know, your need to somebody else having the crazy genes. First of all, do you think at that age, did you feel like there was something wrong with you?
Oh, I know something was wrong with me. Absolutely. Yeah. Because I did things, well, when I look back, I mean, how do you explain getting in trouble, doing mischievous things, and then lying to the teachers at school saying that my mother held my head to one side when she was, and put water in my ear? I mean, I think about the lies that I told her. My mother could have went to jail for telling you. I told her that. Now, my mother made me mad about something, so I told my teacher that when I took a bath, and the way that mom would punish me, that she had me hold my head to one side and she would pour water in my ear. Sometimes they would break different teachers in to interview me about these things, and then I didn't have social workers then, and then I remember them calling themselves giving me a psychological test, and they put me in a room that had, they took me downtown, and I remember seeing, there was a program on television, you're too young to remember, called Dragnet.
Thank you for the compliment.
Okay. Well, they, you know how they had the two-way mirrors, so they put me in this room, and they were watching me, and they didn't know that I knew they were watching me because they had two-way mirrors. I couldn't see them, but I knew that they could see me, and they gave me these pieces to fit. There was a rectangular, there was a square, and there's a circle. And they gave me these pieces to fit them appropriately inside of these carvings. And I guess that was supposed to give them some kind of psychological profile. So I took the rectangular and tried to force fit it into the circle. And then I had a little knife that I had in my pocket, a fishing knife. So I took that knife. I said, I can get this. I can make this fit. And they came in. They came busting the door open. No, don't put the knife down. I said, no, I can get it. I can fix it. I can carve it. I thought they put me back from the fifth grade to the fourth grade and labeled me educable, mentally retarded.
And that's the point I'm trying to get to. People label our children.
And then when I was in the eighth grade, I failed because they held me back in the eighth grade because I didn't make the grades, right? So they had convocation where you would march from from the ninth grade to the tenth grade. They did something called convocation. So I was so upset that my grades did not allow me to pass and I could march with my brother, and it was embarrassing being called the dumb twin.
Mm.
And I waited. So what I did was, as they lined up for convocation, it was on a Monday. Now, it was in the school auditorium, and they come down marching just like for graduation. Dun, 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 dun. They march. It's a very nice formalized event. I spent that whole weekend, starting on Friday, I got me a box, and I took a string and tied it to a stick and propped the box up. Then I got me some, they had something called Marita bread. This is a Long Ranger at Tonto. They had Marita bread, and not wholesome bread. I got me some Marita bread, and I put little crumbs leading under this box so that pigeons would fly down and eat the little crumbs and go under the box. And then I pulled the stick and catch the pigeons and put them in a cocoa sack bag. And then I went and broke into school and got up in the fan room. It was a big fan room, and I waited for them to come marching down. I stayed up there for about 3 hours waiting, got in there early. And when they started marching in, I released about 50 pigeons. Alfred Hitchcock, the birds. Let me tell you, when he talk about people running and screaming. So I came down and ran to my room, my whole room, and pretended that I was asleep. And I could hear them say, "I know there was nobody but that boy, Leslie Brown." And they came in, and I said, "What's wrong?" I'm trying to pretend like I was just waking up. And but I forgot I had the pigeon feathers all over me, all in my head, and everything. My mama beat me like a man. She tried to push my lights out. She had a boyfriend that was a army judo instructor. So when they told her, she flipped me on the floor at school. She flipped me. Because she would move your head first. So I covered my head. So she couldn't hit me in the head. So, because she was swinging on you. And Baby Brown was tough. She was about 5'5". She was short. But she was strong. She was strong. And so she flipped me. She flipped me when I had that. I covered my head. So she knew she couldn't get a good clear shot for that head. So she flipped me and got on top of me in the school. People were in the shock. They had to pull off. I was good.
Now, and I'm sure at that point it wasn't funny. And I want to get to the serious side of this, to not be so serious. Because when kids are doing things like this, that's why they get sent to people like me, you know, fix this kid, something is wrong. I guess I just don't have any better sense, because when I see a child like that, I figure that child actually has more sense than us adults, and we just don't know how to laugh. What would you say to adults who come across a child like you? What would you say to someone now?
Sometimes kids are temporarily insane. And we don't know what causes that. I have a grandson who's been a good boy all of his life. He just never caused any problems. Out of nowhere, he started stealing. How do you explain that? He just started. He's never, ever done anything like that before. I had to fly to Columbus. He ignited a fire extinguisher in school, so they had to evacuate the kids from school, and they charged him with a second-degree felony, and we had to get that reduced. And he's a good kid. Now, there's no sense in saying, "Why did you do that?" I don't know why I did what I did. I really don't know. And so there are times that kids do crazy things, and so that's what I did. Now, does that mean that they are crazy? No, it's just a temporary situation. And so the key to it is not giving up. Now, there are some kids, I believe, that based upon the magnitude of what they do, that, like I talked to a friend of mine who, I said, she adopted this kid, and I told him, I said, "Look, this is beyond you. This is this level of defiance and what he's doing and how he's disrespecting you and going out, getting in trouble, robbing and stealing cars and running with the wrong bunch." See, I didn't, there was no gang and peer influence. My craziness was all by myself. I didn't have anybody telling me what to do. I had my own crazy program.
You didn't need anybody else.
No, I didn't need nobody, you know. So this boy, he was influenced by gangs in Los Angeles, and he was taking her to court and costing her money. And I said, she was about to mortgage her house. And I said, don't do that. I said, this is beyond you. This is bigger than you. And I said, I don't believe in giving up on kids because of the fact that my mother did not give up on me, but I do know this, that I had a limit as to how much craziness I would do and how much pain I would bring my mother and disruption in her life. There was a limit, but this guy, this boy, he had no limit. And I talked to him. He was a good kid, but he just consciously did those things. And there's some things in life has to, and jail and juvenile detention centers have to teach children that we can never teach them. And so he was over the line. I believe that the majority of kids, I say 95%, are reachable, teachable, and redeemable. But there are some that I feel that you just don't want to risk your income. You don't want to risk your life because if they become physically abusive, you don't want to put yourself at risk, even if they're your own child. It's not even just about children that are adopted. It's about children who have, for whatever reason, something has happened, and they're not acting normal. I mean, because I've had a guy say to me the other night, he said, you know what? He said, you have no idea what you did to me tonight. And I said, what? He said, you were adopted, and you felt obligated to take care of your mother and that she would never have to pay another bill when you turn 18. He said, my mother raised 14 kids. My father left. And he said, I'm embarrassed that I never thought to have that kind of mindset, the aspiration and the golden dream to take care of my mother as you had to take care of your adopted mother. And let me tell you, and his mother was still working. And raised 14 kids by herself. I don't understand that. And maybe because my mother, she raised us, and she said, I said, when will I be a man? She said, when you turn 18. I said, then what happens? She said, well, then I can sit down and you take care of the bills because a man provides and support, that he provides and protects. So now it'll be your time to provide for me and protect me, like I've been doing for you. So she drilled that in this. You know, she says a woman has a man and a job, too. One of them's got to go. So when I turned 18, I said, okay, February 17th, I'm a man now, Mama. And so I was selling newspapers and selling copper, and I used to collect aluminum and copper and different automobile parts and refrigerator parts and take them to the junkyard and sell them and sell mangoes and different odd things that I would find. And so I started paying the bills at 18, selling newspapers, and then I got a job at a radio station as a gopher. But at 18, I became a man and became entrepreneurial to do various things. I promoted a play called Porgy and Bess that was popular during that time. And I did the PR for that when it came at the Coconut Grove Playhouse. I don't know how I knew how to do it, but I figured it out. I just read about it in the newspaper, went to the Coconut Grove Playhouse, convinced the man that I could promote it, and he believed me and gave me the job and paid me $250, which was a lot of money during that particular time.
We have 14 minutes left. For this program, and we have several callers on the line that I know that like to ask questions.
Okay.
So something that you just said really connected with me, because as a single parent, having adopted two boys, a lot of people, well, not really a lot, some people said that as a female, I had no business trying to raise two boys. And that just really angered me, in addition to the fact that people say we need to take them back. You being raised by a single mom, what would you say to that comment, especially for single women who are wanting to raise?
Adoption for single women?
Right, trying to raise boys especially.
Well, first of all, I think one of the biggest lies, one of the biggest, boldest lies ever told, that a woman can't raise a boy to be a man. That's one of the biggest lies. In fact, it is the biggest lie ever told. I am a man because of my mother. In fact, if a woman couldn't raise a boy to be a man, considering the fact that 84% of African-American households don't have a man in them, that 84% of black males would be gay. So I don't buy that ignorance. That's an ignorant statement. I think that a man most certainly can contribute. But we have too many grown boys who are poor role models for our children, and that really that their sons don't even need to see them. I saw a guy the other day going through the shopping mall. Here he is around 48, 49, sagging, got a washcloth hanging out of his back pocket, got a toothpick in his mouth, got a hat on backwards, got two earrings and tattoos all over him, and got three young boys with him. They were sagging. They've got tattoos on them. They have earrings, and they looking like the thug culture. So to me, when you have one out of four African-American males who have been adjudicated by the courts or in jail, they're not good role models. Now, there's some good men. There's some good fathers out there who's doing a very good job. But I know too many young men who are successful, who they are, and doing extremely well, and the only thing, the absence of their father, the only downside to them becoming a man, in my estimation, is the anger that they feel.
Yeah. Anger. That's a whole other conversation.
Not in my life. Yeah, that anger has eaten up so many, and that's why I believe that's the biggest challenge that we're facing, and that we're going to address that with the Greatness Center. The anger that so many young black boys have about not having their father participate in their lives.
And other hurts, in other words, that we tell them that, you know, suck it up. Okay, now we're down to 12 minutes, and I'm going to open up the line to two callers at a time. So I have someone from the 209 area code, the 734. If you'd like to ask Mr. Brown a question, please do so quickly. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
This is Linda.
Stop the please. Hello?
Yes, this is Linda. And I would just want to say, Les, that I really appreciated the redeemable, teachable, you know.
Reachable.
Reachable.
Reachable, teachable, and redeemable.
I love that. And I want to say that I was, you know, in the system until I was 12. And I honestly thought I was none of those things.
Mm.
So I got to be maybe 30 years old. And when I realized in time, looking back on it, that being adopted at 12 gave me a lot of opportunities that I would have never had any other way. And, mm-hmm. you know, someone like you that came into my life and sort of raised me all over again at age 30 with just that kind of attitude. But did you at any time have to have resentments or anger that you had to deal with?
I never dealt with that. You know, the curious thing that for me, my brother was very angry and he said he hated our birth mother and father. And I always say, well, how can you hate them? You don't even know what they look like if they came in the room right now. We've never seen either one, never seen a picture or anything. I've never had anger. What I have had has been curiosity. When I speak, I wonder, where did I get this gift from? How do I know how to do certain things? I watch my kids, my son John Wesley, my daughter Ona. I taught them how to speak, and they watch me. But there are things that they're doing that I did not teach them. I have a niece named Anisha. She's not a speaker, but I heard she's an actor out here in L.A., and she's doing things that I didn't teach her. My brother, who wants to be a speaker and has been speaking, but we got this from something. There's some things you pick up genetically. So for most of my life, when I became a professional speaker, I've had curiosity. What did my father do or my mother? Which one did I get this gift from? But I was more curious about seeing my father, seeing his face, when I was buying my son's clothes or teaching them how to tie a tie. I was curious, what kind of work did he do? What kind of person was he? What kind of personality did he have? Which one did I pick up my looks from? But not enough to go search for him. And I never had any curiosity about my birth mother. The only time I ever appreciated her was during my talk show and during a training that I had a few years ago. Because this lady on this talk show said, I asked her, what was your experience like coming up being adopted? She says, positive. I said, well, can you remember any negative? And she says, my birthday. And I said, why? She said, because that's the time that I knew that my birth mother thought about me. And I called my brother, and I was doing my talk show. I called my brother. I said, Wesley, I was crying. I said, guess what? Every time we had a birthday, our mama thought about us. And he said, shut up, sucker, and get a life. Do some push-ups.
Oh, okay, we have two other people to the 209 area code area. We're down to 6 minutes. Time flies fast when you're having fun, doesn't it? I believe that Dan is on one of those. Are you there, Dan?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, I do. Yes, I'm glad that Linda went. You talked about 95% are reachable, teachable, and redeemable. That means that the overwhelming minority of children are not. And somehow, your mother, despite your behavior, despite your pushing that envelope with your behavior, could see behind your behavior, and she could see you, and she could see that you were reachable, teachable, and redeemable. How does a parent know where to draw the line, and what do they look for to look past the behavior and find the child? I found it interesting that Linda said she didn't see herself as any of those things.
I think when a child becomes physically abusive, it starts verbally abusive, and when it costs you money time and time again to bail them out of situations. Well, my son, my blood son, okay, not my adopted son, because I do have children that I have adopted that I don't refer to them as my adopted kids. I call all my kids, and I have 10 children. When he went to jail, I'll never forget when I got the call that he was arrested, and I said, is that right? I said, was it police brutality? He says, no, sir. I said, what was it? I had some marijuana. I said, are you there? Can you hear me? He said, yes, sir. I said, our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm praying for you, and that's all that I have for you. I said, take care, and hung up. So I don't believe in getting anybody out of jail. I don't care if you brought them into this world or you did not. And I believe that what my mother taught me was choices and consequences, and because I knew she would not get me out of jail, I was not going to do anything to go to jail. So I think you have to draw the line because you have limited resources, and you don't have the money, the luxury to put your house up or to use hard-earned money to bail somebody out of trouble time and time again. I got a friend here in Chicago. Her son has been arrested 8 to 10 times, and the only reason he keeps going back is because they won't let him stay in there long enough to do some time to find out that it's not a picnic, that it's not fun. This is a different generation today, and if they have the influences of their friends and peers, that's going to cause them to disrespect you and want to challenge you physically, or going in and out of juvenile detention center and you got to hire a lawyer, at some point in time, you've got to cut your losses, and they've got to be able to face the consequences of their choices.
And I was telling in on that is that it's a give and take, and I believe that you're overdrawing your account, and you need to go back and refill. I definitely believe in unconditional love, and there's ways that you can love without bailing out, because I have that situation in my own life. But for the kids to still know that you love them, that they know the conditions of your expressing that love, and regardless of what's going on, even if they're crazy, temporarily, or permanently insane, they still need to know that you're my child and I love you. I might not like you right now, but I still love you. And the difference between liking and loving someone, you can like to love someone because you want, you have their best interest at heart, but you like them because you enjoy being with them. So I can love you without liking you. And if you
well,
love
that's what
best,
my friend in California had to do. She ran out of resources and wanted to start getting a loans to get him out of jail. And I said, look, first of all, continue to do what you're doing. You're holding the space that I love you. He knows that you love him. And even though he's acting out, he's done some bad things, but he's not a bad person. And she knew that, and she had that unconditional love for him. And now, after being in there for like 4 years, his letters have changed, and he's had a revelation. There's a transformation that sometimes jail does transform people, where they spend some time and have to think a Malcolm X. There are a lot of Malcolms in these prisons, and so that they say I'm better than this, and I'm not coming up here anymore. And so the biggest challenge with I think the parents are facing today is that this is a drug and thug culture. This is a culture that has anything goes. Anything goes. There are no values. They want everything right now. They want to be thugs.
Sorry,
it's not at work.
You have 1 minute, and this is the real cut us off. I don't want us to end off with a blank. We're down to 1 minute, but I would love to continue this conversation at some point. Will you come back and join us another time?
Yes, I will.
I would be glad
Absolutely.
To have you. And for everyone
okay,
who's
well,
listening,
thank you so much.
This is
Mamie Brown's baby boy and Evelyn Boyd's Pride and Joy.
And we love you.
Love
and
you. Take care.
This is the archives of this program. I'm going to blogtalkradio.com. Talk to Miss E, Heart Talk with Miss E. Please leave your comments and on our Facebook page as well as on the comment page of Blog Talk. And click to follow us and subscribe to us. We'll be back next week with someone from Another Choice for Black Children in further recognition of National Adoption Month. Thank you for being with us. God bless. There you have it, our pre-recorded interview with Mr. Les Brown, Ms. Mamie Brown's baby boy. We hope that you've enjoyed this interview, and we will have Mr. Brown back so that those of you who are just listening in on the recording will have an opportunity to have a question and answer period with him. And I hope that you've taken something of value, as Mr. Brown states, away from this interview. And we would appreciate your comments if you will leave them on our Facebook page at For a Child's Heart Incorporated. I almost said .org. But our website is www.foracildsheart.com.
www.adoptionfreedomnetwork.org. And we look forward to your response. If you are an adoptive parent or an adoptee, especially one who was adopted through the foster care system, please email us because we're interested in talking to you and sharing your story and your journey with the village. Remember, this is November, which is National Adoption Month, and instead of broadcasting every other week, we will have something to bring to you every week this month. As a matter of fact, let me notify you that this is the last Wednesday that we will be recording. Our upcoming programs will be held on Tuesday evenings. That's Tuesday evenings starting next week, Tuesday, November 8th, from 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. Eastern. So we look forward to you being with us. We look forward to hearing your comments, your suggestions, anything. And please share with your friends. And again, we thank you for doing something special for a child's heart. God bless. Good night.